nine times out of 10, when someone is taking the time to break away and do their own thing, it's because they either have a specific point of view or a specific passion that really sort of speaks to maybe not a mass audience, but the customers that I have and the customers that Barterhouse tries to culture and cultivate, I think are those type of people who want that story and feel like if they take an allocation of an 80 case made wine, that they've got something special and it's something that only they have or maybe one other person has. So that's kind of what we specialize in. And, you know, it may not be business savvy to the nth degree, like we're not making 100,000 cases of Pinot Grigio and, you know, flogging them all over New York. But the customers that get wine from us are kind of believing the same stuff we do, which is supporting these small farms, supporting these young winemakers who have a passion for doing it. And we supply them with a market and we allow them to get their product out there to otherwise an untapped group of people.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network, coming to you live every Tuesday from 12 to 12:45. I'm Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues. Nastasha the Hammer Lopez joins us via telephone from sunny Florida, where she's driving around in an RV with Piper and Grace, two of our former interns who are spreading the Cooking Issues love down there in the sunny state. Are you there, Nastasha?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi.
Nice, nice. Call in all of your questions, cooking-related otherwise, too, 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. A little note on the Barterhouse, the sponsor for today. They are our wine sponsors for the Museum of Food and Drink fundraiser coming up in about a month and a half. And listeners to the show might remember that we'd sample some of their wine, Booza, a Tannat-based wine, on the show a couple months back, and we enjoyed it. Right, Nastasha?
Yes, we did.
Yeah, especially with a name like Booza. Booza. All right.
Wait, Dave, how can people get tickets to the museum event?
I don't know. How do they? Why don't you tell me?
Well, first, someone needs to make an invite.
All right. What you're hearing here is Nastasha insulting me on the radio internet
that
I haven't finished the invite yet.
Done.
Yeah, calling me out. Anyway. Very soon, you'll be able to sign on and get tickets to the event and taste some museum-themed food by the likes of Mark Ladner, Wiley Dufresne, Dave Chang. Who else we got? Give us the whole list, Nastasha.
Nels Noren, Carlo from Roberta's, Brooks from Del Posto, Christina Tozzi, et cetera, et cetera.
And a host of amazing bartenders like... We have Audrey Saunders. We have Thomas Waugh from Death & Co. Who else we have? We have Simon Ford from Pernod Ricard. Who else we got? We got more people.
We're thinking about Dale DeGroff. There's a lot of people.
It's going to be good. Let me just put it this way. We beat all of our friends over the head with sticks, and they're going to come in and make some delicious products. So we hope you come. And the date on that is going to be Sunday, March 27th. It's going to be in the afternoon, so we're going to get your drink on early in the day for a very good cause. Okay.
It is an invite.
What? Oh, come on. Come on. People, please. Is it all right she calls me out once, twice? You need to call me out twice?
All right, go on, Dave. Go on with the show.
All right, how was the drink that you guys made in Nastasha? Viewers from or listeners from last week will remember that I had to basically become a hypocrite and sell my soul to the devil and create a blue drink with blue food coloring. How did it come out?
It wasn't your best.
Oh.
It was good. People enjoyed it.
Yeah, people enjoyed it.
Which is important. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Very good, very good. All right. So, Dorothy from Heath Glen Organic Farm and Kitchen, I believe in Minnesota, although I don't know, writes in and said, oh, it says here, Minnesota. I'm a preserve maker in Minnesota, and I've been working with oils and spices, trying to infuse aroma into the jams and jellies upon completion. Of course, the aroma of the fruit and spices and oils is wonderful as they are warm and cooking, but it is mostly lost when cooled and gelled. I've tried infusing the jams at different stages of cooking, and have pounded woody herbs to release oils, used commercial aromatic oils, etc. Most of the aroma is lost after they've come to room temperature, however. Any comments or suggestions? Well, a couple of things. We have to figure out whether you're losing the aroma because, one, the aroma is flashing off into the air. I doubt that's the case because you're cooking and probably sealing it to can it, I would presume. So I wouldn't think they're flashing off. I also wouldn't think they're necessarily being destroyed by the heat during the process of making the jams or jellies. I would guess the two main culprits are as it gels, more of the aroma is locked in, and so you're losing some simply based on gel strength. And the second thing I'm thinking is that these aromas probably are a lot less volatile at room temperature. So what I would do, since the pectin is basically, you know, it'll melt, but it's not going to totally release when you heat it, I would say heat it and see whether the aroma comes back. It could just be a temperature phenomenon where you just need to add more of these aromas because they're going to be consumed colder, either room temperature or cold out of the fridge. So I would think it's probably one of those two things. Either the aromas themselves are being locked up in the pectin network as the gels are being, you know, as it's gelling, or two, it's just a temperature-related phenomenon. The temperature-related phenomenon you could actually check quite easily just by making something and not adding a sufficient acid or sugar content for the product to gel, and just adding it, you know, for the aroma, waiting for it to cool but not gel, and see whether or not the aroma is still there. That'd be a good first test. But get back to us with more details about the procedure and everything like that, and we'll try to work on it. I was hoping to have Harold McGee call in today, but he can't, unfortunately. That would have been a great question for him. That's right up Harold's alley, right, Stasi?
Yeah,
that
is.
Yeah. Oh, and another follow-up, I believe, on last week's show. Someone called in, and their question was they wanted to make cookies, but they didn't want them. They wanted them relatively thick without spreading out too much, but they didn't want them to become cakey. And and they asked whether they could use hydrocolloids. I had a couple of half-baked suggestions. Last week, we spoke to Christina Tozzi from Milk Bar, who's also doing a dessert at the museum event, by the way. And so Tozzi and I were talking, and she actually says that you can add xanthan gum, which you can buy at Whole Foods. You can just go into Whole Foods and buy it. Say whatever his name is, not Red Rover, like Bob Red Mill, something like that. Bag of xanthan gum. And add some, I don't know percentages, I would add probably on the order of a half a percent by weight of the flour basis or something like this, I don't know. And she said actually it does help limit spread. But the most interesting thing she said was try using high-protein flour in your cookies, bread flour or similar. And basically she said, look, it will stop this. It will stop the spread and keep it thicker, but as long as you don't increase the leaveners, it's not going to make it cakey. And because there's so much fat in the cookie recipe, butter, in the cookie recipe, you're not going to get significant gluten formation, even though you're using a high-protein flour. So it's not going to make it chewy in a bad sense, in a proteiny way, but will limit spread, and it's an easy way without changing a lot of your formulation. Anyway, so I thought that was interesting and a good follow-up. I can at least pretend like we follow up on some of this stuff, right, Nastasha?
That's right,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Joseph writes in and says, I've been listening to your show for a long time, and I love it. Well, thank you, Joseph. And he has a question regarding ISI or EC. Nastasha, what's the current thing they like? Do they like ISI?
EC.
All right. So EC, they're the good folks from Austria that make seltzer makers, the Twist and Sparkle seltzer making machine. They make whipped cream chargers, et cetera, whipped cream siphons. We use it a lot to do rapid infusions using nitrous, and you can look on www.cookingissues.com for more on that. Joseph wants to know, he's interested in the thermo whipper so he can create hot or cold foams and was wondering what my recommendations are. Okay. So the thermo whip whippers are different from the normal EC whippers, and they're basically just whipped cream makers, in that the thermo whip is insulated like a thermos. All right? Now, the good thing about the thermo whip is if you fill the thermo whip with hot water, really hot water, and then dump it out, and then put a hot product in to do a foam, it stays hot for a long time. Similarly, if you want something cold, if you put ice water into the thermo whip and chill out the inside and then dump it out and put a cold product in, it stays cold for a long time. So it acts like a thermos and like a cream whipper to do sauces, creams, or if you want to keep whipped cream out on the counter for a long time in a coffee shop scenario, something like this, it's going to keep the quality high because the temperature is not going to change too much, right? Now, the downside of the thermo whipper is that even though it looks relatively big, it holds a relatively small amount of product, right? Because there's so much space for the insulation around. It's also very expensive compared to a normal cream whipper. So you're dealing with a lot more money for a smaller volume of product that you can put in the whipper at any one time. So, in fact, it looks like a 1 liter whipper, but it actually has the capacity of a half liter whipper. Now, and that's not a for or against. I'm just telling you like what the reality is of it. Now, the other thing about it is that if you are working in a kitchen, right, so you could take one that's not a thermo whip and you could either store it in the fridge or you could store it in a hot water bath to keep it hot for service. Now, it's much more convenient, right, to be able to just put a hot thing and have it stay hot or a cold thing and have it stay cold, but you're going to be paying for that luxury by, with reduced capacity, which actually isn't bad if you're only making a small amount. You don't want to put a small amount of stuff into a big whipper, so it can actually help if you're dealing with small quantities, but you're going to have a smaller quantity and a higher cost. Now, it's just something you have to weigh out. There's nothing that the thermo whip will do for you that the other ones can't do. They just make it easier to maintain temperature. All right, Joseph, so I hope that answered your question. Hope you decide which one you want to buy. Of course, we at the Cooking Issues, fans of the EC folks, right, Nastasha?
Yes.
Yes, that's what I thought. by the way, we still can get calls even though you're on the phone with us, right?
Don't worry. I would never block that.
Oh, my God. I would never block that. Like we have so many people pounding on our doors with calls. But let me tell you, since we're about to go to our first commercial break, I would like to hear some callers at 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Cooking Issues.
How you feel, brother?
Feeling good.
You feel good? So much bone, brother. How you feel, man?
I'm feeling all right.
I call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here. How you feel, fella? Hey, yeah. Sure getting down. Look at him. Ha. We're gonna have a bunk.
Welcome back to Cooking Issues. Calling all of your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. I'm here for another half hour or so. And, of course, Nastasha's hanging out in Florida driving an RV up and down the coast. So she had to stop the RV so that she could call in. How's the driving going, Nastasha?
We actually just picked it up, and I'm in the RV shop.
You're actually in the shop?
I'm in the shop.
So you're staring at the RV. Is it a sweet ride?
Yeah, it's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What does it get, like half a mile to the gallon? What does that thing get?
About that, yeah.
Yeah, and you're packing how many people into that?
Five
people into an RV? Awesome. So are Piper and Grace giving you the hairy squint to get the hell off the radio?
I'm the one who's been pushing everyone to go, so I made them all go get food and gas while I'm...
That sounds like you. That's why you're the hammer. Okay. We had someone call in, actually with some, write in rather, with some comments on our sponsors and my relative either enthusiasm or lack thereof for them. And so I thought I'd share some feelings and, maybe make an apology to one. But a while back, we have a sponsor. I think they're still a sponsor, 360 Cookware. They don't have me read that one anymore. But basically, it's a line of cookware that it claims to use a steam technology to enhance the speed at which food is cooked and also, lock in nutrients or something like that. And I was told that I was kind of rude and insulting to them on the air. In fact, Nastasha told me that afterwards, and then I kind of tried to make up for it the week after. But I just want to say a little bit about what happened with that. Here's the deal, right? So my whole life is based around food and food equipment and things like that. And so I always take with a huge grain of salt any sort of claim made by any sort of corporation that anything can do anything outside of my realm of normal experience. And the problem isn't that I read the sponsorship thing without actually ever having evaluated the equipment. And so it's hard for someone like me to straight read something that somebody claims is true, have it come out of my mouth without me being able to verify or know. And I'm also inherently skeptical of any claims, right? So, you know, it seems that, and that's probably why they don't have me read these things anymore. But yeah. but I don't, it doesn't like reflect on anything I know about that company. It reflects on my lack of knowledge, and it's just, it's hard for me sometimes if I get caught off guard and I don't have the time or the resources to do the proper research. It's hard for me to say something either good or bad, and so it can come off as snarky, so I apologize. But that same reader heard, we have a sponsor here, Sam Edwards. And actually, was Sam Edwards our sponsor? No, Barterhouse was our sponsor today. Sam Edwards from S. Wallace Edwards and Son Ham, you know, I've known him for a long time. He makes delicious ham products, and this reader actually remembered that and went back and tried the actual ham, the Suriano ham that was being sold at Murray's Cheese on his way through Grand Central, and indeed thought it was a delicious ham. So, people, I do not steer you wrong. Also, I wish it wasn't called Suriano ham. I wish it was just called delicious Virginia ham from the S. Wallace Edwards and Company, but that's another story that I've already gone through. Right, Nastasha? Yeah?
That is right, yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, and seriously, I think that's why they don't have me read these things anymore. I mean, I don't know.
I think that's it, Dave.
Yeah?
I think that's it, yeah.
I'm not a bad guy. It's just if you catch me when I'm not, you know, when I don't know what's going to go on, it's just, you know, I never know. Even I don't know what I'm going to say, you know? Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, so we had a question about the Martha Centrifuge story that we talked about. Martha Stewart Centrifuge story. It's not like Oprah where, you know, if you say Martha and you're talking, people know what you're talking about, then obviously you can just say Martha. But, it's, you know, there are a bunch of Marthas in the world, whereas there's only one Oprah. Anyway, I like the Martha Stewart Centrifuge story. And by the way, Martha Stewart last week canceled on us because of inclement weather. And so Martha Stewart's Centrifuge is still chilling at the French Culinary Institute. It's being moved from hallway to hallway because it has no has no home. So do you know when we're scheduled to do that again, Nastasha?
She hasn't gotten back to me.
Maybe.
And I sent her the videos of the coconut and carrot. Yeah.
One centrifuge for sale. Right? It's like like the old, like we have just this centrifuge floating around. Anyway, he liked the story, and he'd like to see. He sent us an eBay link to another centrifuge, asking whether we could fix it up and give it to Oprah. And it was hilarious. I went to the centrifuge link, and it's an old Clay Adams Jr. centrifuge. And the most hilarious part about it is that you know, for those of us who enjoy a good-natured ribbing of our Canadian northern neighbors, but the it meets all Canadian Engineering Standards Association warrants. Anyway, what it basically is a motor with two test tubes that it swings around in the air, like swinging the test tubes around, you know, in the air with no kind of covering. And it was a whopping on eBay, $159.99, which is preposterous for a centrifuge of that type. I mean, ridiculous. I mean, because it's unusable, basically. It's completely dangerous. They still actually make manual centrifuges that are completely open like that, and they come either two or four test tubes, and they have a crank on them. And I've considered buying them several times. Kent Kirschenbaum, our buddy from NYU, actually enjoys these. Just because they make, like, you know, an awesome kind of like helicopter noise, and they look incredibly dangerous, which I assume they are, but they're currently only used really for petroleum and oil analysis, because you could take them out in the middle of nowhere and spin samples down to check, you know, I guess oil levels, and there's a certain, you know, in a particular sample, or you can or solids levels in dirt samples, but unfortunately, and I believe Paul sent us that one. Unfortunately, they don't achieve G levels high enough for us to use them for juice clarification. You know, in the videos that I've shot of the inside of our centrifuge that I have yet to post because I'm a jerk, 2,000 G's is about the minimum where the stuff starts really clarifying at an appreciable rate. But even at that thing, at 2,000 G's, it looks like it's clarifying, but it doesn't form a pellet in the bottom of the centrifuge buckets that's strong enough to be able to really decant it properly without like becoming hazy, resuspending some of the crap. So really, you want like 3,000 to 4,000 G's, which unfortunately these guys won't do. I think they'll do just under about 1,000 G's. And the other problem is that 4 50-milliliter test tubes isn't really enough to make fruit juice for your even two close buddies, much less 200 close buddies. And so, you know, although we've considered buying one for demonstration purposes, I don't think I would be. Although, I don't know what Oprah wants to do with a centrifuge. Hey, listen, if Roper wants us to fix up that centrifuge, we'll do it. We'll even make it safe, right? We'll build a box around it. You know, we'll shine it all up. I'll get our intern Brooke, who's the master cleaner, and she'll make that thing look better than it was new. It'll look like I don't know. Anyway, it's perfect. But if you really want a dangerous old centrifuge, Paul, may I suggest that you go for the Sorval, or as they were known before they changed their name to Sorval, the Serval SS1 Super Speed Aluminum Centrifuge, which is basically just an 8-position, 50 mil rotor. Aluminum rotor, like from the 50s. It looks like a Jetson thing on a motor on a stand. And there is little that has scared me more in my food cooking life than firing up the Sorval SS1 Dangerfuge and having that thing going at full speed in a kitchen. Nastasha, did we ever throw that away or did we save it for sentimental reasons?
We gave it to an intern.
Really? Who? Piper?
Yeah. I don't remember who took it, but...
Yeah,
someone took it.
You know, we had to give it away because my inherent problem is that if I own it, I will be tempted to run it for some reason or another, right? And it's just a terrible, terrible idea. An awesome, awesome paperweight and a terrible, terrible idea to use. All right. So, Ken Ingber sent us some questions, and one of them's on ultra-pasteurization milk and its cheese-making properties and its foam-making properties. And so he recently was working on making mozzarella cheese from scratch, although, you know, most people when they're making mozzarella, especially if you haven't done it before, I recommend buying the curd first and then testing your mozzarella skills on just the, on the actual pasta filata part, on making the cheese in the hot water. That way you can perfect that portion of it before you go to the actual part of making the curd. Although we all know that I would also do the same thing and go directly from milk to cheese, and there's no way I would buy my curd. So I obviously think you won't do that, but I should just like to say that I should recommend that. Anyway, so one instruction everyone gives is to avoid ultra-pasteurized milk because they don't form curds properly. And so he's not using ultra-pasteurized milk for that. But then I went to look it up and see why. It's actually quite interesting. When you pasteurize milk, you denature a certain part of the whey proteins. Basically, I think it's beta-lactoglobulin, right? And as they denature, they have a tendency then to to adsorb onto or to complex with the casein. And what happens when you make cheese, when you make curds with rennet, which is the enzyme that's used to make, you know, most cheeses, is that it basically cleaves off a hydrophilic part of the casein micelles, and makes it such that they're more hydrophobic, and because of that, they tend to aggregate together and form a cheese curd, right? Now, if you pasteurize your milk too much, too high a temperature, or for too long, the denatured whey proteins basically glom onto the casein and prevent them from forming a good gel, from aggregating together and forming a good gel. So ultra-pasteurized milk, you really can't make a good, strong curd out of it. There's been some studies recently, I didn't get a chance to read it too much, though, that's not the only thing going on, because they basically removed all of the whey proteins from milk, so it was just basically a casein suspension. Then they heated that, and they still had problems with getting it to aggregate properly if it had been cooked to higher temperatures. So there's actually more than one thing going on with it. But a lot of people have been... There's a bunch of reasons why you'd want to pasteurize to a higher temperature. One is because certain cheeses have infection with Clostridium tyrobutyricum, which I'm sure I've pronounced incorrectly, but it makes butyric acid later on in the cheese ripening and can make it smell, I don't know, what's a good word? Vomit, like vomit. And so they try to kill that with ultra-high temperature pasteurization, but it really stops the cheese from ripening properly later in the process, because it also destroys some native milk enzymes that are needed for the protein ripening further down the line. So that's what I spent my morning reading about, that kind of stuff. But he actually wasn't interested necessarily in making cheese, but in whether or not ultra-pasteurized milk is going to make a difference in frothing for cappuccinos. And I don't know. I assume it would, because the protein in milk is one of the things that's helping form a stable milk foam when you're frothing cappuccinos. And so I would assume, and you know, as we all know, milk loses a lot of its, not as we all know. If you're a cappuccino head or a milk frothing head, you know, most people recommend not taking your milk as you're foaming it much above, I mean, they don't recommend taking it much above 140 a lot of the times, Fahrenheit, really 150 in that range. Otherwise, if I don't take it up there, my wife thinks the drink is too cold. But presumably you're inhibiting the formation of foams with a similar reaction where you're basically inhibiting the ability of the casein to act as a good foam stabilizer. This is my assumption. I don't know. I could be 100% wrong, but this is my assumption. So I would assume that ultra-high pasteurized stuff does not foam as well, although I have not tested it. But what I was more interested in is that it turns out that – oh, and he was also asking because he has a little thing called an Aerochino, and even though he's the fellow that wrote in about the AeroPress, apparently the Aerochino is not related to the AeroPress. It's a little thing that foams milk by having a little squiggle-doodle. Oh, what do you call it? Spring? Squiggle-doodle? Squiggle-doodle? What? Anyway, it whips a little spring around and heats the milk to create a foam. And yeah, you know, you can make a good foam just by agitation. You don't need an aero squiggle to do it. You know, when I'm, you know, in the wilds, and by that I mean at my mom's house or at my mother-in-law's house, you know, I always foam milk by shoving a whisk into a coffee mug, heating the milk and swirling the whisk back and forth between my hands, you know, spinning it almost like a chocolate frother, like a Mexican chocolate frother. And it works okay. It doesn't work great. And I think, you know, it might be possible to get a decent, and the question for any kind of foam head with coffee is not, can you produce bubbles? Because any moron can produce bubbles. It's whether you can produce a microfoam, right? So like the real coffee heads, if you show them a foam that you made in your cappuccino machine, even if you really like it, right, but it has lots of big bubbles on the top, they're like, that's dishwasher soap. That's crap. You know what I mean? They want like a dense, stable, or semi-stable, but very dense kind of microfoam, almost, you know, where the bubbles are so small that they're almost, you know, imperceptible when you look at them. They don't look like a big batch of bubbles. It just looks like a dense, creamy foam, and that's what they're looking at. And I have my doubts as to whether or not you could use a spring to do it, although I'm probably wrong. I'd like to see someone, maybe I haven't had time to go on Coffee Geek, which is a great website for you coffee heads to go onto, but I haven't had a chance to go on and see whether or not anyone's created a really nice microphone with one of these little whip doodles. Nastasha, you think of a better name than whip doodle. But even more interesting than that is that Ken is an owner of a La Chimbley Liberty lever machine. Right now, for those of you out there who don't know about lever-pulled espresso, or, you know, don't drink espresso. And if you don't drink espresso, go out and learn to drink espresso. But if you like espresso, as I do, you know, you're going to at some point spend a lot of time researching lever-pulled machines. Now, I myself am an owner of a micro-Chimbley, which is a small lever-operated Chimbley is an espresso machine manufacturer, but I'm an owner of one. I don't use it anymore because it's a big pain in the rear. But lever-pulled espresso machines, to my taste, make the best espresso that you could possibly have. Now, my relationship to espresso machines goes back to the mid to late 90s when I was going to restaurant auctions in New York City and buying restaurant equipment on the cheap. I realized very early on that, you know, there's no way I was going to buy myself a home espresso machine, because, you know, everyone on the internet, and I was reading the professional baristas were like, you know, there is no home machine that can make real espresso. And back in those days, there really wasn't. I mean, there was the Ranchillo, with the Silvia was, I think, around at that point, and people were modifying it, but no one had modified the machines to the level that they're modifying now. So really the only thing you could do was you could get a real commercial espresso machine, which is what I did. I went to an auction, and I believe I said this on the air once before, but, the New York Times has auctions in the back of their, or they're used to, in the back of the Help Wanted ads, and restaurants are closing all the time here in New York. So I went, and this one, I was super excited because the restaurant had been shut down because they had been dealing drugs out of the restaurant. And what that meant was that the whole building had just been padlocked and all the food was still in there and the stench was enough to like completely like blow your pants off. It was that bad. The stench was so awful. And what that meant was is that none of the normal restaurant equipment dealers or chefs could stand it, right? Because, you know, they had other things to be doing with their lives and dealing with this horrid stench for hours. Me, on the other hand, as a just ex-grad student with about two nickels in my pocket, and desiring a professional espresso machine that cost thousands and thousands of dollars was like, this is an awesome opportunity. So I stuck around, bought a two-head Ranchillo commercial espresso machine for like $100 and change, and paid a literal just got out of Rikers ex-crack dealer crackhead to drive it. To drive me with it in his station wagon back to my house, my loft at the time, I knew so little about espresso machines at the time that I didn't realize that the pump was a super important part that was separate, and I accidentally left it in this guy's car, and I had to call him and like go to his house and retrieve this pump. It was a complete nightmare. But anyway, it launched me on my love of espresso. But I became interested in lever machines at the time because another way to generate really good espresso without having like a big pump is to just basically use your hands to have a piston to force the espresso out, because espresso is, as I've said on the show before, not possible at the lower pressures that people are using. You really want somewhere in the area of 135 or so, plus or minus a bunch, PSI of pressure pushing coffee at a very precise temperature through a compressed coffee puck, you know, in 22 to 28 seconds. That's espresso, right? That's it. That's all you got. There is no more. So the lever machines are great, and there's always a fight between true lever heads who say that lever espresso is better, and the people who use the pumps and say the pumps are better. There's two basic lever styles. The one that everyone gets, the Pavoni, Europiccolo, right? That's the one that you see in the stores. It's all shiny chrome. In that one, when you pull down on the piston, you're applying the pressure to the actual coffee puck and putting the water through. In all commercial espresso machines, and interestingly, in the Chimbley micro Chimbley lever machine, which is a home machine, all the commercial ones, your hand, when you pull down, is engaging a spring. And then when you release it, it's the actual spring that's providing the pressure. And for years, many people wrote in their blogs and whatnot that the reason that lever-pulled machines were better is because, or different anyway, is because lever-pulled machines had a constant pressure, whereas the rotary pump that we use in modern espresso machines is not as even a pressure, right? And that's why they say that's the difference between the two. So basically, then the difference is, in a nutshell, that you get more crema in a rotary pump machine, but you get a smoother tasting cup in a lever pull machine. And I didn't think about this, and then I did a lot of research on it because about 4 or 5 years ago, I went to the National Restaurant Association show, and someone was pulling shots out of a lever pull Vittorio Arduino, which is not aesthetically not my style, because it's all gussied and hoarded up with brass and all crap like that. But this guy pulled two shots, one out of that, and one out of a La Marzocco, which is a sweet machine sitting right next to it, and same barista, same beans, and the Arduino blew the La Marzocco out of the water. It was one of the best cups of espresso. It was definitely the best cup of espresso I've ever had in Chicago, let's put it that way. But it was one of the better cups of espresso I'd ever had. And I resolved right there that I was going to figure out the lever machine. And here's what it is that makes a lever machine better than a pump machine, or to my taste, better. It's not that it's smoother. It's that the pressure changes, right? Because I had been thinking, if I was going to build one of my own, how do I compensate for the fact that a spring is going to exert more force when it's when it's compressed more, and did Nastasha get lost off the thing? It's going to exert more force when it's compressed more and less when it's compressed less, right? So it's not that the rotary pump is more is less even. It's that the spring pump actually changes its pressure from the beginning of the shot to the end of the shot, which makes for, to my taste, a smoother, better cup. And so one thing I've been working on for the past couple of years, and I haven't finished building yet, although I have done handmade tests of it, is an espresso machine where you can adjust the pressure during the shot. And the true story is that if you manually adjust the pressure from high, right, at the initial part of the shot, a little bit over 140, and then drop it down towards the end of the shot, you can do a lever pull shot with a lever pull style shot with a rotary pump. Jack is telling me that we're going to go to our next commercial break, so call in all of your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128.
You feel good? Play so much bone, brother. How you feel, man? Call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here. How you feel, fella? Hey, yeah. Sure getting down. Look at him. Ha. We're gonna have a bunch of good time. We're gonna have
Welcome back to Cooking Issues. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Someday we'll play that song long enough to get to the down D, funky D part because, you know, it's all about the down D, funky D. One more thing interesting is that about pasteurization, going back to ultra-pasteurized milk. Jack says he's not been able to ever adequately froth ultra-high pasteurized milk, you know, even like the fancy organic stuff. And the reason, of course, that they ultra-high pasteurize that stuff is so that you can increase the shelf life, I guess, because they have small distribution runs. But another interesting thing on pasteurization in general is we have a new clarification technique in our centrifuge that I haven't written about yet, where we use a combination of silica sol, kieselsol, and chitosan, which is a polysaccharide unfortunately derived from shellfish, so you know it's not for vegetarians, where we can now clarify lime juice in our centrifuge in with 98% yield or more. It's crazy, and it's super fast. It doesn't involve agar or any other nonsense. It's awesome, and it's all stuff you can buy at a homebrew shop, but unfortunately you have to own a centrifuge. But what's funny is it doesn't work on pasteurized Tropicana orange juice. And so if anyone out there has speculation as to why I can clarify fresh orange juice and fresh grapefruit juice, but I can't clarify pasteurized orange juice, but I can clarify pasteurized grapefruit juice, please let us know, because it's something that I can't figure it out. So I don't know what's going on. Got another question in. Actually, more of a comment, something to think about, something I hadn't thought about. A while back, someone asked us about different tubers. So we did a kind of tuber of the world thing. And one of the things we mentioned is that, well, a lot of tubers, like cassava, have can have potentially deadly levels of cyanide precursors in them, so they need to be treated properly. That other ones have very high levels of oxalic acid. And so, you know, which is a usually concentrates in the leaves and whatnot, but have to be cooked properly. One of those is taro. So we were talking about taro, you know, the same stuff that you make, taro pudding out of and all that, taro chips, all that. So we were talking about oxalic acid, and one of our listeners brought to our attention the fact that there is probably a more occurring now, but less known disease called oxalosis. And so, it basically causes kidney stones. If you have kidney stones, it means that you're not getting rid of your excess oxalate. It's something I hadn't thought about. But what he said is that the science is crazy, because the list of foods doesn't seem to make any sense. So you can have all the ingredients in French toast, let's say, but you can't have French toast, and you can't have. There's a whole list of things that you can't have. I would encourage anyone to write in and tell us anything they know about this. I'm interested in it. My mom just got over a really, really bad bout of kidney stones, and so it's something I'm interested in. So if anyone writes in, we'll do a little thing on diet and oxalic acid and oxalate oxalosis, but it's definitely something that we should be more attuned to, something that I hadn't really thought about. Nastasha tells me that I have a bunch of questions that I haven't actually gotten to because I've been yapping about stuff that I'm interested in. So, Nastasha, what are those? What questions am I missing out on? Do you know?
I forward them to your email, but one guy wants to know how to make great brisket.
How to make great brisket? Cook it right! I'm kidding. Mm-hmm. No, if you want to make a great brisket, the question is what kind of technique do you want to use? I mean, you can do a low-temperature cook on a brisket, but it's not going to have the same taste and texture as you would have like a classic Texas-style brisket, because it's an entirely different cooking technique. Both are low and slow. In a classic technique, you're using the poor heat transfer of the medium and plus the evaporation off the surface of the meat to ensure that the meat doesn't dry out too much during its long cooking period, although that sounds contradictory. I think it's what I meant. Whereas if you do it at low temperature, you're typically going to be doing it in a bag. I would probably cook it on the order of the length of time that I would cook. If you're doing low temperature and you want to basically throw it into a Ziploc bag with a little bit of fat, I would say, depending on what you want, between 60 degrees Celsius for about 56 hours, or I would try all the way up to 63 for degrees for like 48 hours, or even as high as 65 for For like 36 hours or so. But if you want the brisket to have that cured taste, then obviously you're going to have to put some TenderQuick or some nitrite into it to get it to have that cured taste, and then vacuuming it down would cause that to penetrate faster. But I haven't read the email, so I don't know exactly what is being looked at. I only, you know, this is just off the top of my head, like different things you can do to brisket. Does that answer pretty much the question, Nastasha, having not read
it? Yeah, I mean, he just said that he saw your fried chicken recipe, and he wanted to know if you had any good recipes for brisket. So.
My fried chicken, which one? On the Food and Wine?
Food and Wine, yeah.
Yeah. You know, when I do fried chicken at home, I still love that recipe. Carlo here at Roberta's has like a crazy recipe that I think is derived from the Pies and Thighs franchise, which had closed and then reopened here in New York. And they have an insanely easy recipe that really makes me kind of upset because I liked it, but it was, you know, goes against all of my knowledge of good chicken making. And that is they take it directly out of the brine, the chicken. They don't dry off the skin or anything like that. And they throw it directly into AP flour, I think with maybe some salt and pepper. I don't know, remember if they added baking soda or baking powder, but no egg, no nothing, no milk, and then fry it directly. And I thought it was pretty good. What do you think, Nastasha?
Yeah, it was delicious.
Yeah, anyway, so that's something I'm going to research on fried chicken. But currently, the problem with fried chicken when I make it at home is that fried chicken has to be fried at a lower temperature than French fries and onion rings. And so the way I always used to do it is I'd fry off all my chicken, ramp my temperatures, and then bust out all my fries, which is fine at dinner, but at a party it becomes kind of a hassle because you can't throttle your fryer temperatures up and down like that because I have a 35-pound deep fryer at home, which is a commercial deep fryer. So what I do now is I do cooking for what I call low temperature for insurance. I bag cooking insurance, that is, not like, you know, insurance like for your house, is I bag all of the chicken in the in a very small amount of the milk brine, very small amount, just enough to get a good seal on a Ziploc bag. And I cook the breast meat at 64 for about an hour Celsius, and I cook the leg meat at 65 and a half for about an hour, and then I pull them out. And when they're hot, I pull them out of the bag and put them on a grate so that the skin can dry off just from the heat of the evaporating off the chicken. And that's the crucial step when people do a low temp before they fry that they forget to do on a chicken, because they let it cool in the bag and then they pull off and they get really bad adhesion of the flour and batter to the chicken skin. So the secret is pull it out when it's hot, let it flash off in the open. Then I do my traditional breading technique on it, which is it goes into a buttermilk egg. It goes flour, buttermilk egg, baking soda, baking powder, and then back into flour, and then you fry it. And then I can fry the chicken at a very high temperature, same temperature as my fries, and I know it's perfect every time. I don't have to worry about it going over or under. I don't have to stick a knife into it and stick it against my bottom lip to see whether or not I've cooked all the way through, which is what I used to have to do all the time. So it's a really good way of doing chicken if you have an immersion circulator or some access to low temperature. Otherwise, you have to just cut the chicken pieces smaller so that they cook through faster. Did I have any more questions I didn't answer, Nastasha?
Yeah, someone wants to know how to do duck confit sous vide.
Ah, so duck confit sous vide or low temperature if you don't have an actual vacuum machine is an interesting problem. So we don't do low temperature. In other words, we don't cook it any lower temperature than you would normally cook it, because confit, the texture of confit, is only achieved at the higher temperatures you'd associate with a normal braising. However, sous vide is a fantastic technique for doing confit for several reasons. First of all, you still have to cure the duck legs beforehand, right? You have to cure them with salt and, you know, whatever herbs you normally rub in, let it sit overnight. But you don't need a lot of fat. This is the primary thing that's great. You don't need a lot of fat to do confit sous vide. You could basically bag the leg by itself with maybe an extra tablespoon of fat, if that. Seal it. You can seal it really hard because you have a bone in it, so you need to seal it pretty hard. And normally when you seal poultry on the bone, the problem is the blood is sucked out of the red stuff, sucked out of the bone. It can lend pinkness to the meat that doesn't go away even when you cook it. But confit is cooked so high that you don't need to worry about it. Then just throw it into simmering water in the bag for, you know, 3 hours or so until you feel that you can feel the bone through the duck meat, and you know it's done. Pull it out, let it cool down, a little on your counter for 20-30 minutes, then, you know, put it in the fridge or in an ice bath and chill it down, and it's perfect. It's so not messy compared to normal confit. You can do individual leg portions by themselves, so you can easily, you know, if you're a family of two, you can, you know, cook the breasts for, you know, one thing, and then just confit just those two legs, and then serve them whenever you want. And so it's really super easy for someone to confit, especially at home when you don't have a zillion duck legs lying around and you don't have like buckets of duck fat and you haven't been saving duck fat from rendering all the breasts like they do in restaurants. The thing's never going to overheat. It's never going to go bad. So it really is a fantastic technique for doing duck confit. But I would basically just use simmering water, or if you have a circulator, set it to about 85 Celsius and run it that way until it's done. And I think it's great. I mean, it's not necessarily better than traditional confit. It's probably a little moister. It's not necessarily better, but it definitely is a great, great way to do duck confit, especially at home. Did I have any more that I missed?
No, because it's time and your time's up.
Yeah, but did I miss any?
No.
No. All right. And here's one more thing on the way out. I am going to soon write my post on U.P. Hedrick's Fruits of New York series, the greatest pomological reference library of all times. And yesterday I acquired the last two. I'm actually missing one more, but the last two of the series. And so now I am the owner of the greatest pomological reference series of all times. This has been Cooking Issues. We'll see you next week.
Oh, you did that. Got me on this corner, and I don't know where I'm at.